Voice of America presents Conversations with African Writers. This is Bill Castle of the African Service of the Voice of America. Welcome to another program in our series on African writers of the 1970s. In this series, VOA reporter Lee Nichols interviews current African authors and presents portions of their works. The writers were selected with the advice and help of African literary authorities, and the Voice of America thanks them for their assistance. On this program, Lee Nichols interviews the Zambian writer Patu Simoko. Mr. Nichols.
Africa is made of clay. She breaks, balanced on heads too proud. I've heard the voices of the marchers shouting, "Black is beautiful." They put wigs where they should have kept pots full of honey and black milk. They shouted, "Black and proud," and their voices were made of lipstick. Those are lines from a poem by a young Zambian writer who is, by his own admission, one of the angry young men of the new generation of African writers. Writers who are not satisfied with the trends and thinking of the 1970s, who seek more radical, more self-analytical solutions to the problems of post-independence Africa. Patu Simoko is the son of a village headman in eastern Zambia. In his mid-20s at the time of our meeting, he had already worked as a journalist, teacher, and book reviewer for Zambian publications. His own poems have been published in a Zambian literary journal, read on international radio, and a volume of his poetry was being prepared for publication. We met in a hotel room in Lusaka, and he told me about his attitude as a writer.
When I had my manuscript read my exam, the National Publishing House, they let me have a look at some of the comments from the editors. One editor said that he thought that I was most outspoken writer in Zambia in terms of the, you know, that I have not been afraid to discuss any issues at all in my poetry or even in my writing. Well, I review books for, say, you know, the Zambia Information Services magazine. But his opinion was that I was most angry and most outspoken in my writing.
Are you an angry young man in your poetry?
An angry young man? That's what I am. I take the political line, and as one would assume, in the context of the African situation, I would be much more leftist in my writing, and I think that is what I actually am. I mean, I try to express what I consider as the bad influences on African, not necessarily from outside, but from the wrong values that are being followed by the various African governments.
For a closer look at Patu Simoko's writing and what he's trying to say, let's go back to his beginnings as a writer. He comes from a rural center called Petauke in Zambia and was educated in Zambia through secondary school. He studied journalism at Evelyn Hone College in Zambia, a technical college specializing in arts and other professions, and worked for 2 years on the Times of Zambia and the Zambia Daily Mail, followed by another 2 years as a journalist in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam. At the time of our meeting, he was teaching journalism at Evelyn Hone College in Lusaka. He said he began writing seriously when he was in secondary school. I asked what led him to start writing.
That may be a bit difficult to explain, but I found that I just, you know, got into it. But what actually had me writing, really, I don't have a full explanation, but I think I just developed a liking for writing.
Well, you just sat down one day and started to write a poem?
I would probably say that I have been fascinated for a long time by the works of other African writers. So I was reading almost every African writer series novel that I could get, and from there then I said probably I should try and see what I could do, just as my colleagues had published works.
Had you read poetry too?
Yes, I was reading poetry. I would say my first most serious was Quino's Travels. Paul Edward wrote the book is about a slave who became an important man in America later on. This is a life story of this slave, but at the end he had some poems which I read, and I was very much fascinated. I was also read seriously Deft Diop's poems. So my influence really and inspiration were drawn directly from Equino's Travels and David Diop's writing.
David Diop, whom Mr. Simoko mentioned, was a Senegalese poet who died in a plane crash at the age of 33. Equino's Travels, the other work referred to, is the autobiography of an African named Olauda Equiano, edited by Paul Edwards and published in London. Mr. Simoko's first poems revealed his early concern with African values as he perceived them, starting with criticism of the use of contraceptive pills by African women.
I was writing about the morals of the changing African society. My very first poem was on the use of the pill by African women. I was saying in my poem that it was going to be a bad influence on Africa if African women started to use the pill. So I think from the start I was concerned more with African culture and morality than with any other specific subject. But I have shifted to a situation where my poems are now more political than anything else.
An example of Patu Simoko's themes is found in the poem I quoted at the beginning of the program. I'll read it all the way through now, and Mr. Simoko will tell us what he had in mind when writing it. Its title is the same as that of his collection of poems being published by Nexam. Africa is made of clay. Africa is made of clay. She breaks, balanced on heads too proud. I've heard the voices of the marchers shouting, "Black is beautiful." They put wigs where they should have kept pots full of honey and black milk. They shouted, "Black and proud," and their voices were made of lipstick. They marched. Africa's nice, we're right, this being night. Africa's nice, we're right, this being night. But brother, take away your Africa. Africa is mud thatched in grass. She catches fire and burns to ash. She cries for pride more bitter than songs of the proud blacks and the beautifuls. Africa is clay that breaks in the violence of the storm. Africa is the storm breaking her own pots. Africa is made of clay. Mr. Simoko explained the poem's message.
There is a tendency by some Africans to say that they are proud of being black and that they are black and beautiful, and such terms which I consider as nonsensical, because I think it's not really what you say which is an expression of whether you're really proud or not proud. I am saying, for instance, that in this poem, Africa is made of clay, that you get a situation where, for instance, you find some girls wearing wigs or bleaching their skin, and yet the very same girls will go about saying that I'm proud of being black. So you have a situation whereby she is very consciously destroying her blackness and saying that she's proud of being black. And I say that this element of being black and proud really must be considered in this way, that being black is really like having a clay pot. If you don't balance it properly on your head, it's going to break. And Africa really, in that sense, is made of clay. It's breakable. So unless we are firm with ourselves, if we say one thing and do the other, we will find ourselves in a position whereby our clay pot called Africa will break.
I asked Patu Samoko if he had a general goal in his writing, if there was something specific he wanted to get across.
Yes, I guess I would say that there's something specific which I'm trying to say. Now, the writings of David Diop, David Diop was from West Africa. He died in a plane crash in 1960. If you read his writing, there is a certain element which interested me. For instance, where he discusses a problem in his writing, the end is always optimistic. Whatever problem may be being experienced by a community, he always says that we are going to win in the end. So when I read a lot of African writing, I saw that that element was being omitted by most African writers, whereby people were faced with a problem and they were not so sure as to whether or not they would be victorious. So I was trying to show this, that whatever problems, we come out the victors.
What role do you consider that the writer has, the creative writer, in your society?
I would say that the role of the writer is primarily to give hope to society. For instance, in a society where you have dictatorship, it is the role of the writer to show that whatever political machinations may be pursued by the dictatorial authorities, the oppressed will come out as the victors. So in this sense, I see the role of the writer as giving hope to the people who are being oppressed. He must not merely depict a situation where people are being oppressed and then omit to indicate whether the people so oppressed who come out as victors or still remain victims.
You are listening to an interview with the Zambian writer Patu Samoko on the Voice of America series, Conversations with African Writers. Now back to your interviewer, Lee Nichols.
We come now to the question of audience. For the audience a writer seeks often helps to determine not only the form, but the content of his writing. Mr. Samoko said there was a discrepancy between the kind of writing he does and the audience he wants to reach.
My audience is the ordinary Zambian. But ironically, you see that the type of medium that I've chosen, poetry being such a complicated medium, I direct my message at the ordinary Zambian, but through the educated few. I don't know how such a thing would work, but my assumption is that if I can get the message across to the educated Zambians, then probably automatically, since they are the ones who hold power in various sectors of the country, then probably they will change, or society will change for the better.
You don't rule out, do you, the possibility of a wider audience than the Zambian audience? I mean, are you interested in having your message heard more widely throughout Africa, or the world for that matter?
Yes, in fact, in all my poems, my perspective is Africa. As a continent, I do not speak for the ordinary Zambian as such, but for the ordinary African, whether they be in Indo-Asia or West Africa or in East Africa. So I'm very much interested in a much wider audience.
I gather as yet you have not yet reached an audience beyond Zambia, except one of your poems was read on the BBC.
Yes, actually, my poems were featured on two occasions, 1970 and 1971, on the BBC. But other than that, really, I have not yet got out of the Zambian audience.
Getting back to his poetry itself, Mr. Samoko talked about several that had social or political themes. He mentioned one specifically called "Why Did Maria Become a Pro?" meaning a prostitute.
What I am trying to show here really is that prostitution is not created by a girl's liking for it, but that it should be seen as a creation of the social and economic factors. There's a girl who she's a very good girl, a decent girl. She meets a man who tells her that he loves her so much, but when they get married, they experience so severe problems that in fact it is much happier for her that they divorce. And after the divorce, because of the existing economic and social factors, she finds that she cannot make a living, she can't remain alive, and the only way she can do so is to go for men at a price.
In a different mood is a poem of Patu Simoko's of a much more personal nature, addressing himself to the loneliness of the poet in a world that cannot satisfy a mind fed on fire. It's called My Last Poem. This is the song of the poets who live whole lives in dreams, whose lips are full of songs of sorrow and cheer, composed for others familiar with joy. The poet's fancy burns in a nightmare. Their every dream hangs over a fire. The little bliss, where is that when their woe immortalized over the flames of their lines? The world has bought their books, chanted their songs, and for wisdom quoted their lines, for once never thought of the poet's grief, eating bitterness in everything sweet. They've made love to women who sought fascination in the arms that composed so many lines, but for once never thought of giving their hearts to the man in their arms. The poets are crying in the arms of prostitutes as they cry in the lines to anonymous loves, always yearning for the best with a mind fed on fire. This is the song of the poets, the song of full-length lives in hollow dreams. This is the song of the poets. This is my last poem. Actually, it's not Patu Simoko's last poem by any means. That, if nothing else, would be out of keeping with his philosophy of preaching optimism. We are going to win in the end. A poem which more typically illustrates this philosophy is called Africa, and Mr. Simoko talks about it.
In the poem called Africa, I am concerned with another African country where you had people fighting for independence, but some of them became beggars and some became the rich people. And I'm saying that at the end that whatever may happen, we shall use our poverty to destroy their wealth. But although we may be victims of the present situation, there's no doubt that we are going to come out as the victors. We are going to win the battle. And in this sense, I would say that I have been concerned with my role as a hope, as a guidance, telling the people that whatever happens, really, we should remain hopeful that we are going to win. So basically, this is the type of writing that I have. There's certain situations where I find that the message may not be direct. I mean, when I say the politician shouted African socialism, but somebody else took away the remains, here what should happen is implied. But where I say that we shall really destroy them, and this is the people. I use we in most of my poems. We meaning the masses, the people, we shall, with our poverty, the same poverty that we have, we shall use it against those who are oppressing.
Or have you written any, what one might call lyrical poetry, love poems, poetry dealing with nature, with mountains, with rivers, with village life, or anything like that?
No, I have not. When I was first starting, I did try to write some love poems. I guess this is because I had the situation, I had the inspiration from the people that that loved me, I guess, and those that I loved. But my use, how I bring in, say, nature in terms of rivers and so on, mountains, I have been in that direction influenced by Leopold Senghor. You know, some of Senghor's poems, for instance, the word Africa and woman, the two words are interchangeable. So he could be talking of the mountain or the rivers when in fact he's talking about a particular point, about the body of a woman. And this is exactly how I bring in such images in my poems.
We turn next to the practical aspect of writing. And I asked Mr. Simoko what he had found to be the chief problems of a writer in Zambia.
One of them is the lack of publishing industry, which is very, very frustrating. Even where it exists, I do not think that they're really moving at the speed that a writer would have wanted. And the problem of the publishers trying to censor themselves because they expect that certain people may be offended in various ways. Other than this, I think we more or less facing the same problems like any other writer in any society, where you have a situation which may not be totally acceptable in the view of the writer, and he is using writing as a way of indicating which direction the society is in fact supposed to be going, as against the actual direction they are going. You can expect that the problems will be those of how much can you say, really, how far can you go in this direction, and so on.
How do you see the future of writing in Zambia?
I think the future for writing in Zambia really, I would say, bright. I mean, the type of writing that has been coming out, in my view, have been not of the acceptable standard, because there has not been enough expression of what is actually the crucial movement of Zambian life. You get a novel like Tickly Sensation or Victims of Fate, both of which are by one author, Gideon Pirin. Now, these two novels are concerned with the problems of the young people. Tickly Sensation being really concerned with the problem of a young man who is caught up in this problem of having to know a girl. Now, I think unless really we discuss things much more seriously, or as an East African writer put it, unless we see beyond the knickers of a woman, we are not being concerned with the serious problems. The other writings, the vernaculars, at the moment I am in the process of reading vernaculars, all the Zambian languages, for review in the Zambian Information Services magazine called the Z. And I must say that it's not very impressive at all. There's a tendency to explode about situations instead of exploring them, which I think creates a literature which will be mere caricatures. You see, the Zambian writer, he does not understand his characters as well. He may show them in his physical form, but we don't really get into the mind of the characters. And I think that this is not as it should be. But reading some of the new works coming out, I think that there is hope that Zambia one day will make its name and be recognized internationally. And I think we are not too far from that situation.
Mr. Simoko had plans for his own future writing following the pending publication of his first poetry collection, Africa is Made of Clay.
After this book comes out, so I have another manuscript, a poetry manuscript. So after this one, I will submit the other manuscript, and I then intend to experiment more on the level of oral literature. And then afterwards, I may sit down and attempt to write a novel. This is because I feel that there's much more limitation in terms of audience when you use poetry. You can communicate much better and much more widely if you use, novels, short stories, because poetry is much more specialized, and really there are a lot of problems in that. So I'm thinking of writing a novel at some stage in future, but after I have published at least three volumes of poetry.
To conclude our visit with Patu Simoko, I'd like to read you one of his poems that he suggested for this program. This one, a nostalgic look backward to the village songs and dances he knew as a child. It's called On Returning to the Village. We return to a village abandoned. We cry for the music of ancestral days. Will memories alone give back our dances? Father, we return, kneeling at your feet. You, owner of the hills and the rivers and the harvests, bringer of peace and winner of all wars on earth, listen. We are the drummers returning from the cities where, out of maize bags, we fed fat and abandoned the praise songs of your seasons. We are the prodigal singers who left your rivers to drink from city taps and forgot to compose in praise of your springs. We are your dancers who stood by the jukeboxes, no longer in touch with the rhythm of our hearts. We are the ones who left to the village songs composed on lips of singers long dead. We return to beat the drums forever, to call back your lost dreams, when water caught in council taps shall no longer delay the wishes of kingdoms. We return prostrate at your feet, our lips full with songs, and feet hungry for dance. Give us the drum of your ancestors on which to beat the dances of our times. Well, that's Patu Simoko, journalist, teacher, poet, above all, a man who sees the writer in Africa today as one to give hope to society, hope that Africa can solve its problems, that we're going to win in the end. This is Lee Nichols.
You have heard an interview with the Zambian writer Patu Simoko on the Voice of America series, Conversations with African Writers. We thank Mr. Simoko for permission to read three of his poems on the program: Africa is Made of Clay, My Last Poem, and On Returning to the Village. Listen next time when reporter Lee Nichols talks with another African writer, one of the men and women who are shaping the African literature of the 1970s. This is Bill Castle speaking for the African Service of the Voice of America. Thank you. The Voice of America presents Conversations with African Writers. The African Service of the Voice of America welcomes you to another program in our series on African writers of the 1970s. I'm Bill Castle. In this series, we are presenting interviews with individual African authors and examples of their work. The interviews were conducted by VOA reporter Lee Nichols, who traveled to Africa to meet the writers in their own countries. Selections of writers for inclusion were made with the help and advice of African literary authorities, and the VOA thanks them for their invaluable assistance. On this program, Lee Nichols presents an interview with the Cameroonian writer Guillaume Oyono Mbia. Mr. Nichols.
There's a small village called Mvutesi in southern Cameroon that can claim a place of distinction on the literary map of Africa. There, in 1939, was born the Cameroonian writer Guillaume Oyono Mbia, and it is from Mvutesi that he has drawn the material for the plays that have projected him into the ranks of significant African authors of the post-independence period. Mr. Oyono Mbia is unusual in a number of ways. He's one of the few African creative writers that I know of who do original work in both French and English. He's a humorist who lays no claim to a mission other than being a reporter of the problems of traditional people, bumping up against the realities of the modern world. And his own account of how he came to write his first play and how it started him on the road to renown is one of the most amusing I've heard. Let's go now to the Cameroon capital of Yaoundé, where Mr. Oyono Mbia was serving as chef de service, as the French say it, service chief of cultural action and dissemination in the Ministry of Information and Culture. We met in his office in the ministry, and he explained how he happened to write in two languages. He grew up in French-speaking Cameroon and began writing in French. And then he went to a university in England, and while there, wrote his first play in English for a drama contest put on by the BBC, a contest in which he captured first prize. Now, most of his work, his plays principally, have been written by himself in both English and French. In the following interview, for technical reasons, Mr. Oyono Mbia's replies to my questions will be read by a studio reader. Here is his comment on the problem of writing for two different linguistic audiences.
I call what I do rewriting from French to English or English to French. I never translate my plays. I hate it when people refer to my translations. I take into account the different mentalities of English and French speakers, and then the theater experiences of the French-speaking and English-speaking audiences are so widely different that I always try to make not only linguistic but staging differences. My experience in English-speaking Africa has been scanty, and writing in English was a challenge which I accepted, not out of love for the English language, but because I believe a writer who is lucky to be able to speak more than one language should not have his work translated by someone else. So I'm glad in some respects that the English version of my play has gone further than I would have thought.
His first play, Three Suitors, One Husband, was originally written in French. From his own later English version, translations were made into German and to one of the languages of Yugoslavia for its broadcast in that country. Mr. Oyono Mbia began writing when he was in secondary school in Cameroon. His father, a cocoa farmer with no formal education himself, paid his son's school fees, and thereby set in motion the unusual chain of circumstances that led the young Guillaume to write his first play and become recognized. Let's hear how it happened in the playwright's own words.
I went home to Mvutesi from school. It was just before Cameroon independence, and one of my cousins, a girl, got married under about the same conditions related in my Three Suitors, One Husband. I wrote the whole thing down, but not yet as a play. When I went back to school, I told my schoolfellows what had happened, and they were so amused, we used to sit up late at night reading the story. It happened that one of our teachers, hearing the noise, came by to punish whoever was making noise. And he took away my notebook. Before punishing me, he wanted to find out what it was all about. So the next morning, whereas I was expecting to be punished, the teacher said to me, "Why don't you try and write this as a play?" And so I did. He himself, without being a typist, typed the script with two fingers, and this became the play known as Trois Prétendants, un mari, Three Suitors, One Husband.
Mr. Oyono Mbia was then about 20 years old. The play, in its original French version, was performed by his schoolmates. It was not only the author's first play, but the first stage performance he'd ever seen. Among those present was a French teacher from Yaoundé. And by chance, it was this same French teacher to whom the young writer came to be examined for his baccalaureate examination soon afterward. Mr. Oyono Mbia picks up the story.
Instead of the usual Molière, Racine, Corneille, he brought me a portion of my play to read and explain to him. He said to me, "You seem to know everything about Molière, but I don't think you know anything about a young Cameroonian who is now writing, not as well as Molière or Corneille, but still, he is trying his best." The teacher had no idea I was the writer. He hadn't noticed the names were the same, so he gave me a portion of my own play to read. I thought I knew what it was about. After all, I had written the play, so I began explaining what I had written and what I meant. He said, "Monsieur, vous n'avez pas du tout compris la pièce. Mister, you haven't understood the play at all. This young man," he went on, "has been influenced by Senghor and Césaire. You know, I had never read any Senghor or Césaire then." And he went on explaining what the play meant. "This is negritude and so on. Vous comprenez? You understand?" he asked me. "Yes," I said, "but well, I never thought I had said all that much in my play." "What do you mean, your play?" he asked. I said, "Well, of course, you know I wrote it." "You wrote it?" I said, "Of course, I'm Oyono Mbia." "So it's you who wrote the play?" he said. "You are not in France? You are not an ambassador?" The poor man was astounded, and before I knew it, he dragged me to the French embassy saying he has discovered a great talent. Well, that afforded me a 2-week trip to France. I met people from the French Academy, Roger Ferdinand, the president of the French Association of Playwrights, dedicated one of his plays to me. And little by little, my play became known. It was published by Edition Clé, a local publishing house here in Yaoundé, and now it's gone into its 8th printing.
That's the French version, entitled Trois Prétendants, un mari. The English version, Three Suitors, One Husband, was written later, when Mr. Oyono Mbia was in England. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. But I think you might enjoy hearing a portion of the play in its English version. It's about a girl in Mr. Oyono Mbia's village of Mvutesi, who has gone away to school, acquired a fiancé, a poor student, and comes home to her village to find out her parents have already picked out a husband for her. In fact, more than one husband, for the family, having already pocketed 100,000 francs bride price from a farmer who wants to marry the girl, now is getting ready to talk to another suitor whom they think will pay a bigger amount. In scene 2, from which we will read a portion, the girl's father and assembled villagers are awaiting the arrival of suitor number 2, a big civil servant from the city. The civil servant, named Mbia, arrives in a motor car complete with driver and a large supply of beer and wine to grease the negotiations. Things start well, when suddenly, in discussing Mbia's family background, it becomes apparent he is related to Juliet, the girl he's come for. It looks as if the marriage is off. Mbia is about to leave, thoughtfully instructing his driver to pick up the unopened bottles of beer, when the village headman, sensing disaster, steps forward. Here is what happens next as Mbarga, the village headman, speaks.
Listen to me, all of you. I'm the headman of this village. Mbia, our visitor, has come all the way from Saint-Melima because he wants to marry our daughter, Juliet. Well, I know some people here think he is related to Juliet, so there should be no marriage. But what? Shall we be foolish enough to turn down a civil servant like Mbia for such reasons? Don't great men always deserve special treatment? They do, everybody responds. Who will make us all very welcome whenever we go to the city? He will, says everyone. Who will set us free from the police? He, only him, they answer. Who knows, said Mbarga. Won't Mbia make it possible for us to obtain gun permits and medals of honor? Guns, guns, medals, medals, they all shout. Mbarga, continuing to paint a picture of what the civil servant might do for the villagers, says, won't he introduce us in all the offices in Saint-Melima, even in the prefect's own office, without delay? Everybody chimes in, without delay. At this point, Mbia, the civil servant who has been taking this all in, now says to the driver, Ngulu, one bottle of wine for the headman. Mbarga, encouraged by this gesture, continues. Our ancestors used to say, important rivers can only be recognized by the size of their tributaries. I will therefore ask you, if Mbia is offering us so much to drink now, won't he always be doing so? Yea, they all agree. Mbarga, who now has his bottle of wine, rubs it approvingly and continues. Won't Mbia have the price of our cocoa raised? He certainly will, everybody responds. And you were going to reject such an important suitor, a man who is so popular in Saint-Melima, a man I've often seen with the Secretary of State himself. Mbia calls to the driver, Ngolo, two bottles of wine for the headman, who will soon be elected mayor. Ngulu, four bottles. Deputy, Ngulu, 10 bottles. Secretary of State, Ngulu, a whole case. Now, Abesolo, Juliet's grandfather, who first brought up the question of her family relationship to Mbia, addresses Mbia. Forgive me, my son. I did not realize you were such an important man. You see, I'm only a poor old man, but never mind, never mind. I will forget about your being related to our daughter, Juliet. Ngulu, says Mbia, four bottles of wine for the grandfather. Now, the grandfather gets down to the heart of the matter. He says to Mbia, however, there is just one condition. How did you come? Mbia replies, our ancestors used to say, the first day of the marriage is only the beginning of it. Therefore, I only brought 200,000 francs. The grandfather turns to the other villagers and says, didn't I tell you? I realize, continues Mbia, it's only a small sum of money. Ooh, exclaims everybody. Mbia adds, but as I was saying, it's only the beginning. Now at Tangana, Juliet's father, who has been drinking this all in, can restrain himself no longer. You are right, he says. Marriage settled. Give me the money.
There you have the flavor of Three Suitors, One Husband. It's a hilarious play all the way through. The girl, Juliet, steals the 300,000 francs the two suitors have paid her parents, and her penniless lover hands it back to her parents as the biggest bride price of all. In the end, the girl marries her student sweetheart. Now, you remember the author, Guillaume Oyono Mbia, told us the play was based on a similar set of circumstances involving his own cousin. Well, the real-life ending was somewhat different. Here's what Mr. Oyono Mbia told me actually happened.
The girl never did marry the penniless young man. She married the man with the money because the money had already been paid and there was no way out. She got a divorce afterwards and then could marry someone else. I suppose in the play I was trying to show that whatever you do, love or nature will triumph in the end. And one has to come to some sort of ending in a play.
You are listening to an interview with the Cameroonian writer Guillaume Oyono Mbia on the Voice of America series, Conversations with African Writers. For technical reasons, Mr. Oyono Mbia's responses are being read by a studio reader. Now back to your interviewer, Lee Nichols.
While there were no writers in Mr. Oyono Mbia's family background, he may have gotten some of his literary bent from the oral literature of his village childhood. He recalls,
"We had in our family a tradition of storytelling. My mother was and still is a good storyteller. Every evening, she used to gather us small children around her and tell stories in a rather humorous fashion. Her stories were usually meant to criticize our bad habits, to educate us. We got into the habit of using stories as a means of showing people what we thought they ought to be doing. And from my primary studies onward, my teachers said I was gifted in writing accounts of what I saw or imagined. This can no longer be found in most places in southern Cameroon. Ever since we've had the radio experience, instead of listening to stories from the family or elders, people now tend to turn on the radio and listen to stories or anything they are told on the radio. This has to be taken as a sign of modern times."
At the age of about 25, Mr. Oyono Mbia went to England to do a 4-year honors degree in French and English at the University of Keele in Staffordshire. It was in England that he got the idea of attempting to write drama in English.
In 1966, the BBC had organized a playwriting contest and I contributed a one-act play written in English. That was my first attempt in that language. The play was called Until Further Notice, and it got first prize over 340 entries. It was produced by the BBC with an all-African cast. It got published by Methuen and Company in England, and I took advantage of the publication and rewrote my first play, Three Suitors, One Husband, in English, and both were published in the same volume. Later on, I rewrote Until Further Notice in French, and it was published by Edition Clé in Yaoundé. I've also written short stories in French, which I intend to rewrite in English.
Mr. Oyono Mbia's short stories, entitled Chronique de Mvutasi, Stories of Mvutasi, are like his plays set in his home village of Vutesi. The author explained why he used his own village as the locale for his writing.
Otherwise, people would get angry. I'm chiefly a satirical writer, and it wouldn't have done me any good to do satirical writing about someone else's village. But it would be a mistake to say it concerns only my village. My village is taken as a typical village in southern Cameroon. My short stories are concerned with the days after independence. I'm not concerned with the times before. So many good writers have written about those times. My cousin, Ferdinand Oyono, and others like Mungo Betty. I don't think it's really worth going back and exploring what was wrong. It's about time we began looking for what may be wrong in our days, or what may be right. Why not? As you may have gathered, my plays and stories are mainly concerned with social problems, but I don't write about politics. I believe that however good or bad the politics of any country, the effects can only be felt through the influence on people. You can feel whether a country is progressing through the reactions of its people. Some critics say my writing is weak because I don't care about politics. I don't shout, "Down with the whites." Well, I think we've gone beyond the time when we could gain anything by shouting, "Down with the white," and "Down with this and that." I hope we have reached a stage where we can laugh at ourselves. You may have noticed that I tend to treat everything in as humorous a way as I am able to. There is so much misery in Africa and the world. Perhaps, as Molière has said, it's more difficult to make people laugh than to make them cry. I prefer to try to make the audience laugh, and after laughing, they can go and reflect on what they heard and saw.
I asked Mr. Oyono Mbia whether he had a particular message he wanted to get across in his writing.
I'm not a man with slogans. I don't believe in clear-out solutions to problems. I simply want to show people the problems we are faced with. I leave it to the audience to suggest the solutions. The endings of my plays should never be taken as any attempt to suggest solutions. A play is a play and has to come to some ending. And if anybody is careful enough in reading my plays, he would have noticed that the end usually brings up again the problem raised at the beginning.
What audience are you writing for?
I usually aim at audiences in every walk of life. I don't want to write for sophisticated audiences. My wish would be to be able to write plays that could be performed everywhere, that anybody could adapt to his own conditions.
What do you consider the role of the creative writer in your society?
I suppose you would expect me to say a sort of guide. I don't like the word guide or messiah. I think a writer is, like yourself, a reporter, a man who perhaps has a gift not only for seeing, but also for telling people what he saw and they may have missed. I think a writer ought to be true, not only to himself, but to his age. And nothing pleases me more than to have people with no literary pretensions pick up my book and say, "Yes, this is what happened in my village." It is an answer to those critics who claim I should be writing for the future, about what Africa should be in 10 or 20 years. I can only see what is happening now. If anybody is clever enough to deduce from the present what will happen in 10 years, so much the better.
African writers in the 1970s face many common problems. I was somewhat surprised, however, at the answer Mr. Oyono Mbia gave when I asked what he considered the chief problem facing the writer in his country today.
The writer is the most misunderstood man. People don't know that he needs at times to be left to himself to think and to write. They would like to see you again and again, forgetting that the time they are taking, you would like to use for writing. Friends who know you will bring those who don't know you in order to show, well, this is the big man, and they will produce beer and so on. On the other hand, nobody in Cameroon, as far as I know, can make a living out of writing. I have to be in my office at such an hour because my job as a writer is not exactly what I'm being paid for. I write when I have time to, or perhaps when I think it may bring in some money. When there is a system whereby established writers will have means to write without having anything else to do, the situation will greatly improve. As for other problems, I suppose writers like me, who are satirical, have to be careful about what they write. Not everybody has a sense of humor. There has never been a line of what I had written censored at any time. It's all a question of how one presents one's stuff.
Mr. Oyono Mbia, in his post in the Ministry of Information and Culture, is himself trying to encourage authors who bring their work to him, discussing their writing with them and offering criticisms. Though he said sometimes when one begins criticizing, they become afraid and go away. I asked how he saw the future for creative writing in Cameroon.
The future, I think, is very bright. There are so many young writers, especially with the university being established. Previously, people in Cameroon who wanted to write had to go to France or elsewhere to get their higher education. Now, we are having many writers maturing in Cameroon through our universities, so they have both the technical skill, the educational background, and the source of inspiration, since, after all, they are living in their own country. The number of manuscripts received monthly by Edition Clé is also a good sign, a sign of health, if not necessarily of maturity.
On that hopeful note, I concluded my interview with Guillaume Oyono Mbia of Cameroon, thanking him for sharing with us his experiences as a writer and his delightfully humorous plays. Writing as he does in both English and French, Mr. Oyono Mbia is a one-man bridge between two cultural worlds, and as such is playing a part in helping to further the cultural unity of the African continent. This is Lee Nichols.
You have heard an interview with the Cameroonian writer Guillaume Oyono Mbia on the Voice of America series, Conversations with African Writers. For technical reasons, the words of Mr. Oyono Mbia were read by a studio reader. Our thanks to Methuen and Company, publishers, for permission to present portions of Mr. Oyono Mbia's play, Three Suitors, One Husband. Be sure to tune in when Lee Nichols presents another interview with a current African author. This is Bill Castle speaking for the African Service of the Voice of America.